Hi, this is Chris Brennan, and you're listening to the Astrology Podcast. You can find the show at theastrologypodcast.com, and you can also listen to us on iTunes. Today is January 7th, 2015, and this is the 22nd episode of the show. Today I'll be talking with Austin Coppock about some of the major astrological trends and alignments in 2015. He was on the show just a few episodes ago to promote his groundbreaking new book on the Deccans titled 36 Faces, and today he's joining me to promote his 2015 Astrological Almanac, which is available through his website at austincoppock.com. So Austin, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Chris.
All right. I'm excited to do this. This is the first time I've done a podcast that's been more topical in terms of talking about, I guess Patrick and I have talked about, you know, the alignments that were going on with the presidential election, but this is the first time we've done sort of a forward-looking quasi-predictive show that's looking at upcoming astrological trends. And I think you're a great person to do that with, given how much time you spend each year literally looking at the year ahead or the following year and trying to anticipate what the major trends will be in the world based on specific astrological alignments. So let's start first before we get into it. What's your process for writing your astrological almanac, and how much time do you spend on it each year?
Well, that's a good question. So this year, the 2015 almanac, was the fifth time I've done this project. Mm-hmm. And it's changed a little bit year to year, but I think for at least the last three, I start with looking at every day of the year individually, and so I kind of start with the microscopic, and just kind of look at the rhythm of every day, and I usually write out most, if not all, of the daily delineations before I move on to the monthly. Okay. And yeah, and then I kind of build up from there to larger to larger ones, like something like the Uranus Pluto squares, which isn't a monthly or a daily thing, or even a yearly thing. I kind of start small and get big, and then that usually bounces back down to the small, because when you're looking at things on a daily level like that. Just for example, with the Uranus-Pluto squares or the upcoming Saturn-Neptune squares, you see the moon making a T-square to those positions twice a month, right? And you see inner planets hitting them. So you're like, oh, what's up with this, this Saturn-Neptune thing? Because it's going to be, it's kind of a way of pressing the same button over and over and over again. Sure. And so when you do the dailies, you get really curious about what the connecting thread between all these different moments that you've delineated is.
Okay, and that leads you to some of the broader trends in terms of the outer planet transits and placements and things like that?
Yeah. Sometimes I'll have an insight about something big, just in the midst of doing the dailies, but I try to start small and let the big grow out of that. When you do it the opposite way, when you kind of decide ahead of time what the big stuff is going to be like, and then try to make the sort of individual moments conform to that, I think that you run a risk of kind of fitting everything to a Procrustean bed, if that makes sense. Trying to make things fit the formula you think is going to be dominant. So I don't know. It's a back and forth, but I like to start small and then get bigger.
Sure. That makes sense. So what then, based on the work you put into your almanac for 2015, what are some of the major trends, or what's a good starting point for the discussion in terms of what we can expect out of 2015?
Well, there are a lot of things to say. I guess the primary theme, the sort of the year as a, if we're going to look at the year as a whole, is that it's a transitional year, and it's transitional for a lot of different reasons. On a very simple level, it's the middle of the decade, and we see some of the configurations which have characterized the first half of the decade, such as the Uranus-Pluto squares, sort of not quite breathing their last, but climaxing and then beginning a sort of fallout slash integration period. And then we see some things that are really going to dominate or have a lot to do with the next several years beginning to take shape this year. But 2015 is sort of it's placed between the, you know, it's not that the first half of the decade is over and all those themes are done, but those are sort of winding down at the same time as other things are cycling up. And so, you know, and so anyway, and so, yeah, there's a lot of transitional imagery. And I think it's also, I don't know, it's, yeah, we'll get into more into the details. I think if I go on much longer, I'll end up all over the place.
Sure.
Or deep into one detail or another.
Right. Well, in terms of transitions, so I think one of the ways that I've seen both you and other astrologers, such as Kelly Surtees, characterize this year is as being a much more dynamic year in some ways than others because of a heavy emphasis on fire placements or fire signs. Is that right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it's not going to be a gentle, smooth transition necessarily. I think that the new themes will jump out and grab people. You know, as you said, we've got a lot of planets in fire signs this year.
Yeah, what is that again, or what do we have?
So Uranus has been in Aries for years now, so that's nothing new. Mm-hmm. Jupiter has been in Leo since the middle of July last year and will be there until August of 2015. But those two were joined by Saturn, who moved into Sagittarius on December 23rd. Right, so we've got a minimum of one planet in every fire sign until mid August when Jupiter moves, and Saturn does briefly slip back into Scorpio over the summer, but the summer sees Venus in a fire sign Leo for almost 4 months straight. So there's always going to be fire, and there are certain moments, such as in the late winter in March, where you have Mars and Venus rampaging through Aries, and you know it just pushes the proportion of planets and fire signs. I don't know if over the edge, but to a white hot flame.
Nice. Okay, so we've got a minimum of three planets most of the year with Saturn and Jupiter and Uranus and fire signs, and then at various points we get a bunch of inner planets clumping up there as well. When they start going through fire signs, especially Venus going retrograde in Leo, so that it has an extended transit through that sign, with Mars catching up there about the same time, and then Venus and Mars going through Aries at the same time early in the year, and then Sagittarius roughly at the same time later in the year. I guess that would be then, you would characterize that as a year in which the dominant element is fire, and therefore the sort of dynamism or whatever keywords you wish to use for fire would be more prominent this year than, say, last year when we had Saturn in Scorpio and Jupiter going through Cancer.
Absolutely. You know, another particularly important part of that is Saturn. You know, Saturn having moved into Sagittarius about 2 weeks ago. You know, Saturn is often sort of syncretized with Cronus, the ruler of time. We know that Cronus and Cronus were actually different gods in Greek mythology, but our astrological Saturn does seem to have a tremendous amount to do with time. And, you know, one of the things that I've noted about Saturn is, in a sense, Saturn lays down the drumbeat. You know, Saturn lays down the pace of a given period of time. And Saturn in Sagittarius is a much more rapid pace than we've seen with Saturn in Scorpio. And, you know, as some astrologers who've made a study of music could tell you better than I, the types of music that people listen to or that are popular during Saturn in Scorpio are different than those that get popular with Saturn in Sag. Saturn in Sag is fast. There are lots of different styles that were popular during Saturn and Sag during the 20th century, but none of them are slow. Saturn and Sag is somewhat frantic. If we look back to the late 80s, we have hair metal, for example.
So there's a certain... We can expect like a resurgence of Poison and other like hair bands from...
Oh, God, I hope not. But it's definitely not slow. You know, one of the things that's occurred to me just in the last 2 weeks since Saturn entered Sag is that the way I've experienced the Saturn and kind of watching that shift in people's lives, you know, if Saturn sort of demands that we endure a particular set of experiences for a given time, Saturn and Scorpio seem very much about like kind of sitting back and trying to emotionally process various poisons which infect our world system. You know, Saturn and Scorpio brought out all of this kind of grotesque stuff about race and class and gender. You know, and we're sort of subjected to this horror show of what some might call the shadow elements of our collective life. And, you know, in a corresponding way, horror movies are very popular, horror shows, horror stories are very popular during Saturn and Scorpio, at least as far as the 20th century is concerned. Most of our monsters come from there. And so there's this, you know, and when you're watching a horror movie, you know, there's not much you can do. You're just sort of subjected to it. And it's about how you can deal with it or not. Whereas Saturn and Sag, I've noticed, again, just, you know, on a small level, Saturn and Sag seems to be demanding people get up and do things. It sort of demonstrates the idea that, you know, water signs are inherently passive relative to fire signs, which are relatively active, mm-hmm. This yin and yang thing. Because Saturn and Scorpio is kind of like, all right, deal with it. Whereas Saturn and Sag is like, all right, now go do all of these things. And you're being timed.
Mm, interesting. Yeah, I mean, that in terms of that shift with Saturn moving into Sagittarius for, what, the next 3 years, that's definitely one of the biggest shifts that's taken place that will, I expect, be much different or will be indicative of the type of differences and the sort of starkness in the differences compared to the last 2 years where Saturn's been in Scorpio. And one of the things I'm actually looking forward to about that shift is just seeing how some of those placements of Saturn going through Sagittarius play out literally, because especially with Saturn and Scorpio, I found it really interesting just how literal many of the sort of global news stories were as Saturn was moving through Scorpio, in terms of bringing out some very Scorpionic, some very classic Scorpionic types of situations and news stories and things like that. And we had issues dealing with pretty much from the very start of Saturn in Scorpio in late 2012 all the way until the recent past. We had news stories dealing with privacy, issues of secrecy, issues with spying, issues with hacking, sex scandals that started like with one of the U.S. generals, I think it was like Petraeus or somebody, in November of 2012. And that was actually one of the very first stories within a month of Saturn going into Scorpio, where what came out of that was that him and his mistress were like corresponding through Gmail or something. So some of the stories that came out of that sex scandal originally were things about like privacy and like how to have better privacy or not get hacked or what have you. And then, of course, we had the Snowden leaks that came out the following year in June, right around the Saturn station in Scorpio. And then finally, even most more recently, we had the North Korean hacking scandal with the whole debacle over the Interview movie and Sony getting hacked and things like that. So the literalness of some of the manifestations of Saturn in Scorpio was really fascinating to me, and I'm interested to see if it's just as literal with Saturn going through Sagittarius now.
Yeah, that's well, I mean, if any planet has a reputation for being literal, you know, I think that's Saturn.
Right. Yeah, and that's brilliant, because it's not subtle. It's not, you know, we're not reading between the lines here. It was all very straightforward. And even now with Saturn and Sagittarius sort of in the last few days, just today actually, one thing that sort of struck me as almost sort of Saturn and Sagittarius perhaps, and I hope I'm not stretching it too much, but with the murder or the assassination of the French cartoonist and the shooting that just took place today in Paris, over the cartoonist writing or drawing depictions of the Muslim prophet Muhammad. And what's interesting is what's come out of that, or what I've been noticing in the news media on the New York Times and CNN and on Reddit and places like that is it's sparking this whole discussion about religion and criticism of belief or criticism of Islam and, of course, criticism especially about religious zealotry. And I think that's kind of fascinating, and I wonder if that's not sort of the start of, with Saturn in Sagittarius, a trend that we're going to see become a lot more prominent in the next couple of years until Saturn leaves Sagittarius in, I think, 2017, in the same way that we saw some inklings of what Saturn in Scorpio would be like with the Petraeus sex scandal right at the beginning of Saturn in Scorpio.
Yeah, I think that's actually very insightful. And I don't think it's out of bounds to look at questions of belief or a hardening of religious, or just a hardening of belief, whether it be religious or ideological, with Saturn in Sagittarius. You know, as you well know, Sagittarius is traditionally ruled by Jupiter, and Jupiter, especially in traditional astrology, is seen as the religious planet, right? And so if you have religious concerns, or just we can just say concerns surrounding belief, anchored in Sagittarius, you know, it's Saturn's job to harden and to concretize the territory that he's placed in, right? And so, you know, and so what do we call those people? We call them hardliners, right, for whatever their belief system is. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I think that that will certainly be a part of Saturn in Sagittarius. One thing, you know, one of the things that I came across when I was doing my thinking about Saturn in Sagittarius before it had actually ingressed was, I don't know, I was seeing a lot of articles being posted by astrologers using the metaphor of going on a spiritual quest. And so, you know, and this is for personal astrology. It's not necessarily, you know, they weren't necessarily speculating about the collective. But, you know, you do have this mobile armed figure with Sagittarius, which is really the, you know, essential to any quest motif. You have somebody searching for something that has meaning and overcoming challenges, right? They have to be mobile and armed.
Sure.
But as I was thinking about, you know, it seems like there are kind of two questions that Saturn in Sagittarius poses on a personal level and also a collective level. And one is that, you know, do you have a meaningful long-term goal? And meaningful long-term goals have to be anchored in bigger pictures of the world, right? Like, what is the point of doing all of this, right? Because you have to have a point to want to do things, right? Like, what is your, you know, if we're looking at the metaphor of the archer, like, what are you aiming for, right? And so that's where a lot of the big stories or grand narratives that people anchor their lives in come into play, whether it's, you know, a Christian narrative or an Islamic narrative or a Hermetic narrative or an atheist narrative, right? They're all stories about the whole world. And then once you have a story, there are certain tasks that make sense. And then there's the question of, you know, do you have the grit and determination to accomplish what needs to be done according to the way you see yourself in the world, right? And although there are a number of people who have the grit and determination to accomplish what they see as their work, I think Saturn in Sagittarius will be revealing for many people an error in the way they're seeing the world or an error in the very quest that they set out on. You know, I think that people will be discovering after being, you know, quote unquote, victorious, that they actually were on a fool's errand. And I think that these, you know, the attackers in this case in France are a good example. You know, they certainly had the necessary qualities to accomplish what they wanted. But I would argue that, as I think most people would, that the entire quest was worse than a fool's errand, right? And so, you know, with these kind of questions burbling throughout the micro and macrocosm, you know, people will be questioning ideologies on one hand, they'll be questioning their beliefs, but also defending them and digging in, right? The question is sort of where to dig in and what path to follow, right? And a lot of people, when their beliefs are questioned, dig in defensively, mm-hmm. right? Rather than allowing themselves to be uprooted from what might actually be, you know, unfertile ground. And I think, you know, as you and I were saying earlier, these questions that I think can be subsumed under primarily just under Saturn and Sagittarius are really exacerbated by one of the bigger configurations that starts this year but doesn't really get going till the fall, and that being Saturn in Sagittarius is squared in Neptune in Pisces.
Which
we're going to see a lot of in 2016, but there will be strong there will be strong precursors this year.
Because Neptune's only at like 5 Pisces right now, so Saturn does get pretty close before it stations. It gets to like 4 Sag before it stations this spring, right?
Yep. Yeah, so it chases it. Like, you know, right now it's a 4-degree applying aspect. That's a real aspect.
Yeah, that's an effect.
It was in effect as soon as it went in. Right. And, you know, Saturn and Neptune are going to roughly pace each other. So Neptune will have pulled ahead of 5 by the time Saturn gets to 4. Mm-hmm. And then Saturn will head back and Neptune will do its thing. And then they actually meet in the fall. And we get a bunch of, one thing to, I guess for everybody to remember when you're looking at like a square in the sky, it's going to hold for a while. You have to remember the 30 different moments where there are going to be T-squares, because something, you know, if we've got Saturn in early Sag and Neptune in early Pisces, you know, what about the time periods where all of the inner planets go through early Gemini? What about when they go through early Virgo, right? You have all of these T-squares that are promised. You know, you get 2 a month just with the moon.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, that makes sense. And then you get the activation or the triggering of those outer planet configurations that are lasting for so long, sort of narrowed down in the specific time frames.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, that's interesting. And then just obviously on a more personal level for a lot of people, at least from my perspective, or a way that people can relate that Saturn and Sagittarius shift from Saturn and Scorpio to Saturn and Sagittarius through their own charts is, at least for myself, using whole sign houses. When you start using whole sign houses, you realize that an ingress of a planet into a new sign is not just a shift of a planet into a sign, but it's also a shift of that planet into a new house. And that's actually one of the ways that you can test whole sign houses to see if there's anything to it, is to see if when you have major outer planet changes like this, if you start seeing different topics or different areas of a person's life starting to become activated. Like it's been, for the most part, very entertaining over the past 2 years for me to observe all of my Leo rising friends who have all had major changes, or many of them have made major changes in terms of their home and their living situation over the past couple of years as Saturn was going through Scorpio because it was going through their fourth house. And now all of a sudden we get Saturn for the Leo rising people shifting into their fifth house. And so we have topics related to, let's say, children is one topic coming into play and becoming more prominent for the next 2 or 3 years. But just about everybody can do that in order to sort of personalize some of those transits. And in some instances, especially if that part of your chart's being activated through other ways, you're going to see that Saturn transit through that new house, emphasizing new topics. So that's one thing in terms of personalizing it. The other personalizing thing, of course, and this blows my mind, is that all of the Saturn and Sagittarius kids who were born in like 1986, 1987, up to 1988, I think, are now having their Saturn return.
Yeah, I think it's November of 88 when it shifts.
November of 88. Okay, so is it 86 to... Yeah, I think it's 86 to 88, somewhere around there. Okay, so all of those kids that were born then are now beginning, they've just begun their Saturn return as Saturn has ingressed into Sagittarius. And all of the Saturn and Scorpio people, such as myself, are rejoicing because their Saturn returns are almost over. But unfortunately, it's not quite that simple, because Saturn, of course, will come back into Scorpio, will retrograde back into Scorpio June 15th, and it will stay there this year all the way until September 18th.
It's almost exactly the summer quarter.
Right. Oh, yeah, that's a good point.
It's like solstice to equinox within a few days.
Fantastic. So that's like another summer of Saturn return for the Saturn and Scorpio people, especially those that got nailed by it over the past couple of years. Great. So I had a keyword for that. I forget what it was, but it was something like you know, not quite finished yet, or checking to make sure that what you learned, what you were supposed to learn during that transit.
Yeah. I always think of it as one last thing.
Right. Yeah. You were finished and out the door. Saturn's heading out the door. You're saying goodbye to him, and it's been nice hanging out. And then he's like, one last thing.
He's like, oh, I forgot. Just, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. It only goes back to 28. Saturn only goes back to 28 Scorpio before stationing direct. So it's only those, like, the very end of people with Saturn and Scorpio that are going to get a direct hit.
Right.
In my experience, when I was having my Saturn return and Saturn returned to Virgo for a little bit after he'd ingressed into Libra, I didn't have, you know, big events take place, but I instantly felt like I was in my Saturn return again. You know, with the Saturn Virgo, I had this sort of blanket of worry and anxiety that I was snuggled up in for a couple of years, and it went into Libra and I just felt it disappear. And I was like, great. And then Saturn went back into Virgo for just a little bit. And I was like, oh, it feels like this again.
Yeah. And I already have a great example of that, even though it hasn't happened yet, which is one of my friends, unfortunately, had a parent who passed away. They were Leo rising, and they had Scorpio in the fourth house. And so Saturn transiting through Scorpio was transiting through their fourth house, and their mother passed away. And their mother is an Orthodox Greek, or was in the Orthodox Greek Church. And apparently there's something like there has to be 6 months before they can hold like the final funeral services, or there's some sort of funeral services that take place 6 months later. And the way that it ended up happening was that got scheduled for exactly June 16th. So basically the day after their mother died at the very end of Saturn and Scorpio in their fourth house. And then it leaves and moves into Sagittarius, and the transit's over. And then June 15th, the transit comes back, and Saturn comes back for sort of a final visit through their fourth house. And presumably during that time, there'll be like the final, you know, like you were just saying, a sort of reminder of that. And they'll be back to that sort of feeling of where they were. And then gradually over the next few months, it'll go away once Saturn leaves that sign.
Yeah,
so that's like
absolutely
a really concrete example of exactly what you're talking about. For many people, for some people, it will be that concrete, and that they'll probably return to some of the issues that they may have been dealing with when Saturn was in Scorpio over the past couple of years. And for others, it might be more of a metaphorical or more of a sense or emotional sense of whatever that time was for them.
Yeah, yeah. I wanted to actually have a great example of Saturn's ingress being really obvious. So I just want to back up to that very briefly for
sure.
One story. So I was traveling to I was traveling on December 23rd, the day that Saturn ingressed. And and my host is a person with Cancer rising, right? And so this puts Saturn, that meant that Saturn ingressed into his sixth house of health issues. On that very day, as I was approaching in the car, this was a bit of a drive, there was a call, and he was actually in the hospital because he'd had a problem with his foot that had gotten inflamed for no reason that anybody could tell, but it was so bad he couldn't even walk.
Wow.
And so it was interesting. He finally got out. It was a bit of a drive. When I got in late that night, he greeted me on crutches with one leg up, right? You know, one leg held up.
Okay.
And so what's interesting about that is, one, it's a really obvious Saturn is now in your sixth house of health problems,
right,
transit.
Mm-hmm.
And also, you know, if you look at how Saturn is depicted in, especially in alchemical manuscripts, it's a cripple with a crutch, and one leg up. Like one of his legs, he's got a bum foot.
Okay.
And so I see my friend, I'm like, oh, Saturn has marked you. This is very, you know, this couldn't be clearer. This is the traditional iconography on the very day that Saturn enters your house of, you know, ongoing, you know, of health problems.
Right. Right. That's brilliant. Yeah. I mean, I probably already belabor this point too much, but really just look, the whole sign houses sometimes are just so stark, it's hard not to pay attention and not to be find that compelling. And I think that's why sort of record number of astrologers are adopting that as a system, at least as a secondary system, if not their primary one. So, okay. So that's one of the major themes, of course, this year is Saturn going into Sagittarius and then Saturn returning for a quarter of the year to Scorpio to have a reminder or check up again on some, just about everybody in whatever house that is that it was going through for you. The other thing that takes place this year, one of the other major characteristic and unique things about this year is the Venus retrograde in Leo this summer. And this one's, well, I don't want to say it's like more important than any other because different people respond differently to different ones. But I remember this one because this one, it's the one that stations in early Virgo. And this time it's going to station at 0 degrees of Virgo and then retrograde back into Leo and station somewhere in mid Leo. And this is taking place between July 25th and August 2nd. But this is connected to the last time this specific retrograde happened was during the summer of 2007. So basically we're having a repetition of an exact retrograde period from 2007, which should coincide with a repetition of some similar themes for many people or similar issues or similar situations from that retrograde during the summer of 2007. So that's kind of interesting and exciting because I actually remember that retrograde. I think I was hanging out with you during that retrograde at one of the Project Hindsight conclaves.
Indeed, I believe that was the last conclave.
That was the very last major Hindsight conclave. Yeah, because they like elected it for the day that Venus stationed retrograde, and everyone said that was a bad idea, which more or less turned out to be correct. Go ahead.
I'm going to avoid recounting too many specifics.
Okay.
I would agree that in hindsight and for many of us in foresight, that was not a fortunate election. Some of your listeners probably know, you know, the Venus retrogrades are really easy to look up in your own life. You know, the Venus retrograde that starts in early Virgo and spends most of its time in Leo, it happens, you know, in the summer every 8 years. So 2007, 1999, 1991, and 1983, and so on and so on and so on. And so you can really get a sense of whether it's really not a big deal for you or, you know, whether your life changes dramatically for the better or worse.
Right.
And
like if you go back in 8 year increments and like every single one of those was a major event in your life, then you can anticipate that this one probably will be as well.
Yeah. And, you know, hopefully you can learn something too. You know, if the last couple times in a row you've made a really questionable decision about relationships and then it bit you in the ass a couple months later, well, then, you know, this time if a sort of questionable situation comes up, hopefully you can say not this, you know, I don't want to do this one again, right?
Sure. Although, I mean, it doesn't even have to be like Venus related or like relationship related. I mean, for some people, it's just Venus retrogrades are acting as an important marker that's denoting important events taking place at that point in their life. Nick Degenbest, I think, has talked about during previous episodes where some people are just really tied into that 8 year cycle and important turning points occur in their life under those Venus retrogrades and approximately basically every 8 years.
Absolutely. Yeah. Venus can have any priority in a chart and can also, you know, Venus can rule any pair of houses. You know, if Venus rules your 10th house, then it's probably going to be something career related, right? If Venus is in your seventh, ruling your seventh, it's probably going to be relationship oriented. You know, Venus has her themes. And so oftentimes, you know, relationships bear on that house. If it's 10th house, it might be, you know, meeting a new contact that then gets you a different job, right? You know, Venus still does her work by means of those, you know, those affairs that she rules. But the outcome can be affect any area of the life, depending on the chart. But yeah, it's easy to look up and see what it means for you.
Yeah, and what house it's going retrograde through, and if it's like a prominent like an angle, or if it's not a prominent house, and so on and so forth. One of the things that's weird about this one, though, is especially in early August, there's like a bunch of important planetary movements that all take a place around the same time, especially in that first week or two of August. But one of the so I guess I'll just list them off. It's like Venus stations retrograde at zero Virgo in mid to late July, July 25th-ish. But then it retrogrades back into Leo by the first week of August. And then at the end of the first week of August or beginning of the second week, Mars ingresses into Leo. So for some reason, we're getting this like heavy emphasis of the sign Leo that summer, basically by the second week of August, where Venus is retrograde there. Then Mars shows up to the party. And then Jupiter, just a few days later, by August 12th, it departs from Leo and actually moves into Virgo, I think, permanently.
Mm-hmm. The retrograde doesn't take it back into Leo.
Okay. And then at the same time, in the first week of August, we have Saturn stationing direct at 28 degrees of Scorpio. So Saturn makes his final direct station in Scorpio. It's just crazy. There's a lot of weird sort of outer planet movements happening during that time.
Yeah. Well, and if you look at like August 5, 6, 7, you have Venus at 20. I'm looking at the 6th. You have Venus at 27, Leo, Mercury at 28, Jupiter at 29, right? And so they're all like making conjunctions with each other or have just made conjunctions, right?
Okay, yeah.
And all of those are square Saturn about to station at 28 Scorpio.
Okay.
Right? So that's a lot of goodness. And so, you know, as far as one of the things that, and part of what I get out of my going through every year, day by day process, is what are hot degrees?
Yeah.
You know, for good and bad, both during a year, right? And so for the summer, like the last couple degrees, let's just say the last 5 degrees for simplicity's sake, the last 5 degrees of fixed signs are lit up, right? And that's not all bad stuff. You know, Saturn can be difficult, but you also have Jupiter there, right? And you know, Mercury is Mercury, and then you have Venus, a retrograde Venus, who does all sorts of things. You know, facilitating cyclical shifts. In regard to what she rules, is mostly what the Venus retrogrades do. But those are some intense moments, and they'll probably be intense for the collective as well as for individuals who are hit by them directly.
Yeah. Especially anybody who has Leo activated somehow this year through perfection or some other Time Lord technique, or somebody that has Leo otherwise, or fixed signs otherwise prominent in their chart. It's just an interesting pileup of planets. And then we get a new moon there, I think, by the 13th or 14th. So the sun and moon are both there as well. It's just very active. So that was definitely one of the parts of the year that stood out to me in terms of that. And let's see, what else? So aside from that, aside from August, one of the things that you had mentioned is that the final Uranus-Pluto square, or exact Uranus-Pluto square, is also taking place this year, right?
Yep.
Okay.
Yep, that's in the middle of March.
March, okay. So middle of March, we have the final Uranus-Pluto square, and it's already 2015, so we're in the middle of this decade, and the decade actually, I think, as you've pointed out, began with Uranus-Pluto squares. This has been a long-running series, I think, of like 7 or something, right?
Yeah, this is the 7th exact square. Yeah, Uranus, if we're going to do like square by sign and then by, you know, applying orb, you know, Uranus ingressed in sort of a preliminary ingress in the spring of 2010 and then went back into Pisces. And then it was March 11th, I believe, that in 2011, when Uranus moved into Aries for keepsies, right? You know, until the end of the decade. And then, you know, that was the Arab Spring. That was the Occupy summer, you know, and this storyline of sort of the, you know, the fed up people versus the evil empire. Has really been the main story in the news in one form or another all over the world since then.
Sure.
Right? There's been this ongoing, you know, tension between thesis and antithesis. Like, you know, we can't do it this way. We have to do it this way. This is the way things work. And what's interesting about that is with Uranus and Pluto, you know, they've certainly made what needs to change very, very, very clear in a lot of cases. I think that if we compare the average American's awareness of issues that the United States is facing now versus 5 years ago, a lot of the problems haven't emerged in the last 5 years, but people are aware that we've got basically a crisis in both lower and higher education. We've got a crisis with our healthcare. We've got a crisis as far as our standing in the world and what roles should the United States be playing. You know, we've got, and we could probably talk about this for an hour, but it's very clear what the problems are. But the Uranus-Pluto square has, it seemed like it's done a good job in some cases, especially with other countries, of demolishing or disrupting previous systems that were not working. Like we look at the Ukraine, right, where they got rid of their guy that they hated, right? But or in Libya, they got rid of Gaddafi, right?
Right, yeah.
But has anything replaced it?
Right,
right. Is there a new order which conforms to the Uranian ideals which began said revolutions? And in almost no cases is the answer yes.
Right,
right. Egypt is another good example. Like Egypt, it's sort of. They got rid of, you know, Mubarak?
Yeah.
Quite some time ago, and now things are, it's kind of like, I don't know. I guess Egypt's doing okay. They have different problems than they did 5 years ago.
Well, no, they had democratic elections. The majority elected the Muslim Brotherhood to power. And then after, what was it? It was like a year, if even a year, the military stepped in and forcibly removed the democratically elected president and outlawed the Muslim Brotherhood, and now the military is in charge again, which is what was the case
basically
when Mubarak was in power.
Yeah. So. And you have very similar stories to that in almost all of the nations that had a really obvious Uranus-Pluto event.
Yeah.
You know, one thing that's really interesting is even though, this is the last Uranus-Pluto square, we're going to entering this era, this time of aftermath, because they'll still be in squared signs for a while, right? But it's no longer applying. They're no longer going to touch, right? Hmm. Is that this is like this last one should actually hit the United States the hardest, because if we look at the July 4th chart. This Uranus-Pluto, this last Uranus-Pluto square is at 15 degrees of Capricorn and Aries. And so that nails the U.S. sun, right? Which is right there. If you look at July 4th, like it's, is it 14 or 15 degrees that year? I don't remember, but it's within a degree, right? And so there, we haven't had a revolution, right? And I'm not suggesting we're going to have a revolution this March, but I think a lot of the other countries kind of had their Uranus-Pluto thing a little earlier, because whatever, they were sensitized to those earlier degrees. Whereas the Uranus, if you do national charts based on like the founding of a government at all, then this year is really when the U.S. gets its most direct hit, which is I think pretty interesting.
Yeah, that will be interesting, especially given the things that seemingly had been the focal point of the Uranus-Pluto square prior to this, which it was a little bit before, but it's sort of first intimations of it might have been like the Tea Party movement, which was more of a 2009 thing, but that even bled into 2010. And then especially 2010, 2011, we had Occupy Wall Street and things like that. Maybe a little later, but basically coinciding with the Uranus-Pluto square. I mean, in all of these instances, though, it's fascinating, like you said, how, like with Egypt, it's like we had these, not reactionary, but these sort of rebellious groups, or these groups that were trying to make sudden change, that were springing up sort of spontaneously and attempting to make changes in well-established systems. And then a lot of them just either getting co-opted or getting suppressed in some way, so that the sort of powers that be in many ways came out on top in the end anyways. And I've been thinking about this for a few years as I've been watching that and wondering if that's not due to Pluto still having this sort of superior position in terms of that aspectual relationship, where this is just the waxing square, where Uranus is still just now building distance between itself and Pluto for the first time since the 1960s when the conjunction took place. And it finally hit the square, but where Pluto is still in this sort of superior position in this relationship because it's earlier in zodiacal order. And it's not really until you hit the opposition and then finally the waning square that Uranus eventually gets the upper hand. So I don't know. That's kind of a downer, a bummer.
Well, I don't know. I've been thinking about that since, 2011, 2012. And I feel pretty good because I had discussions with people who thought that this was going to transform the world and all these problems were going to get solved.
Yeah.
I was like, I don't think so. Pluto's in the superior position.
Right.
And that may have been poo-poo, but, I'm not horribly disappointed with the way things turned out. I might be unhappy with the way that my country works in certain aspects, but at least I wasn't horribly disappointed. I didn't spend all of my energy trying to do something and then have an outcome which was contrary to that. I would also point out that, it's not really Uranus or Pluto's job to set up functional systems, right? That's Saturn's job, right? Like, Uranus is never going to, create a functional healthcare system. That's not what Uranus does,
right?
That's not what Pluto does. Saturn creates order, right? And we can hate him if we dislike the order which has been created and where we feel trapped in that. We can appreciate it if we've got our systems running smoothly. But it's Saturn's job to create and stabilize order. And so, one of my sort of bigger thoughts about this year in context with the decade is that, there's this question of, so we know that the first half of this decade had as an ongoing theme the destabilization and criticism of those systems which were not doing their job. Mm-hmm. And that has been accomplished, right? Now, if we then ask the opposite question, when will systems get built, right? When do we see when do we see the return of order? And again, some people like order, some people don't. You can like the order that returns or not, but when does the order come back? Well, it's obviously when Saturn moves into Capricorn and then Aquarius, which is the basically 5 years where he's in the signs that he rules and is incredibly strong, right? And Saturn's time in Capricorn, which is like 2018 through 2020, roughly, will coincide, or we'll see Saturn in the same sign as Pluto, right? And Saturn and Pluto in a Saturn-ruled sign certainly describe order. And then when Saturn's in Aquarius, Jupiter finally gets back to Saturn, and we have a Saturn-Jupiter conjunction. The Saturn-Jupiter conjunctions were the primary tool for the mundane astrologer for 1,000 years. You can do a lot of really interesting history with them, with these like 20-year sections that occur consistently in one element for about 240 to 260 years, and then they go to the next element and do that for 240 to 260 years. And so not only is that a seed of new order, right? Our last Jupiter-Saturn conjunction was in 2001, and in a sense, we're still living out that 20-year program. We're exactly, this year will be exactly 3/4 the way through with what began in 2001, right?
We have
Jupiter square Saturn this year, so that's 3/4 the way through. But that that next one, which is like the next 20-year chapter, is not till 2021, and that one is not only begins a new 20-year chapter; it actually begins a new several hundred-year chapter because that will be, as I said, in Aquarius, which is an air sign. And it begins hundreds of years of conjunctions of Saturn and Jupiter in air signs.
Right.
So that's a pretty big shift it's not necessarily one you'll see in 2021. It's not like the whole hundreds of years of history will just bloom out from there and you'll say, oh, everything's different now. But it's the beginning of a very big, very long trajectory for the Jupiter-Saturn conjunctions, which again are of tremendous use for actually looking at the astrology of history.
Yeah, the shift into the era triplicity is like a new 200-year, the beginning of a new 200-year period. And we had some preview of that, of course, and there's some debate about when it started because we had the first conjunction in Libra back in like 1980, 1981.
Right.
But then it went back into Earth in 2000 to 2001, and now we'll have the final shift into that new triplicity in 2020.
Yeah, there's the blurring at the edges of these periods where you get a preview of air, right, 81 to 2001. And although, not everything that happened in those 20 years was great, you did have, the Cold War ending, kind of a good thing. No more constant threat of nuclear annihilation. We did get the internet out of that,
right?
Kind of good. Like, no nuclear annihilation plus internet is pretty good. You may or may not like some of the people who were in power at that time, but, that's a big good thing and the erasure of a very large bad thing.
Yeah, definitely. The introduction of the internet during that period of that initial preview of the shift into air signs, I think, is a really interesting preview of what, the next 200 years is going to be like as that continues to be where all of the conjunctions will take place in 20-year increments for the next two centuries.
Yeah. And then it was, and then the Saturn-Jupiter conjunction was in Taurus in 2001. And it was back to battling over goods and, over various goods and
goods
land.
Resources.
Yep.
Yeah, that's brilliant.
So anyway, so there's, that's coming up, right? That's coming up in almost all of our lifetimes, this bigger shift. But, dude, that's not for another 6 years. And even Saturn in Capricorn, which will be orderly if oppressive, that's still years away. We just started Saturn in Sag. And so we're in this period where, we're most of the way through this cycle that we began in 2001. We're aware of a lot of the problems of it. But, it's Saturn in a mutable sign. Sag is mutable. And when you look at it historically, you can really see it. I think I was telling you this a month or two ago when I was working on it, that it makes just as much sense to interpret Saturn in Sag as the lead up to Saturn in Capricorn, right? Because when Saturn goes into Capricorn, things change. Just looking at American history, right? Last time Saturn went into Capricorn, the very end of 88, it was November of 88. And then it's 89, and boom, the world changes. The time before that, it's the end of the 50s, and then Saturn goes into Capricorn, and the 60s begin. And then probably most dramatically, or at least as dramatically, Saturn's in Scorpio, or Saturn's in Sag at the end of the 20s, and people are, crazy and speculating, just like they were at the end of the 80s. And then boom, Saturn goes into Capricorn, have some Great Depression, Americans. Right, like things just change when, like, there's a new, there's a new boss when Saturn gets to Capricorn. Just, and I think that's a simply result of Saturn being so strong there. And so Saturn and Sag are these frantic last days, right? Before the boss comes. And so you see a lot with Saturn and Sag. You see a lot of on a macro level. You see a lot of people just trying to get away with what they can. Right, financially, right? Like, you have the massive speculation at the end of the 20s. You have massive speculation at the end of the 80s. It's mutable Saturn. It's kind of a, like, what can you do? How can you work this? Like, the new rules haven't really gone into effect yet. And so Sagittarius is one of the few zodiac signs whose symbol is synonymous with speed, right? Crabs don't go very fast. We don't know how fast virgins go or scales, right? But the Saturn zodiac on the image, right? It's a man with horse legs. Like, what is that good for? But traveling far and fast, and so there's a little bit of a scramble to Saturn and Sagittarius.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense, and that was an interesting point of Saturn in Capricorn being kind of the, and that pile up in the late 1980s, early 1990s in Capricorn was also the fall of the Soviet Union, which is interesting in terms of that, basically the Saturn return of that also hitting about the time that Saturn hits Capricorn and Aquarius, especially given some of the things that are happening in terms of geopolitics today. So, all right.
Actually, I have two more things I want to sneak in really quickly that are directly related to this.
Okay.
So I was talking about, you know, Saturn, a mutable sign, and the sort of like, you know, get what you can while the getting's good, or just try to figure it out because it's not going to stay this way. Try to figure out the terrain for now and negotiate it as it shifts. As you and I have talked about, there are a number of planets moving into mutable signs, and we're going to be dealing with more mutability over the next couple of years. Just as there's an emphasis on the fire triplicity this year, there's an increasing emphasis on the mutable modality during the second half of this year, and then especially in 2016.
So Saturn in Sag, Jupiter going into Virgo, Neptune being in Pisces.
And then the nodes shift into Virgo and Pisces at the end of this year, in November.
Okay.
Right. So, we'll have South Node on Neptune, which is interesting. Whenever you get one of the nodes on an outer planet, you get interesting stuff happen with that planet. Mm.
And that's partially tied to some of the eclipses that we have coming up, which are kind of weird because they kind of straddle different axes between mutable signs and cardinal signs. So March of 2015, March of this year, we have our first solar eclipse at 29 Pisces. And then right after that, we have a lunar eclipse at 14 degrees of Libra. And then in the fall, of course, it's reversed so that the solar eclipse occurs in Virgo and then the lunar eclipse occurs in Aries. But that'll be kind of like those are good target points for people for a nice like opening and closing of some topics related to whatever that whatever house that falls in your chart, just in terms of the solar eclipse or the new moon as being sort of like an opening or a starting point, and the lunar eclipse often being more of a culmination or a closing point. So those eclipses will be in mutable signs as well, which will kind of kick off some of the mutable stuff that you're talking about.
Yeah, and then in 2016 they'll be more solidly in the mutable, in mutable Virgo and mutable Pisces.
Okay, right, because the nodes will be fully in those signs at that point, and then it's just all eclipses and mutable signs.
Yeah, I've actually done some wondering without coming to many conclusions about the first solar eclipse in Pisces. And that's because it is in the very last degree of Pisces, and then the sun and moon both move into Aries, you know, a couple hours later. Mm. And so if you're doing some mundane astrology and you like to look at Aries ingress charts, right, you look at what is the vernal equinox in the Northern Hemisphere chart every year for a statement about the year, right? And so it's not, you know, the sun isn't eclipsed in that chart, but it's eclipsed like, I don't know, 6 hours before that. And so, you know, what does it mean to have an eclipse so close to one of those angles, at a point in time that is so heavily emphasized by traditional mundane astrology? I don't know what that means, but I think it's very interesting. And hopefully I'll learn something about it this spring.
Yeah, definitely. That is interesting. All right. So, let's see. In terms of the year, though, I think those that we touched upon most of the main themes that we wanted to touch upon. And I'm trying to think of if there's anything that we didn't cover. We talked about the emphasis on fire signs. We talked about Saturn's shift into Sagittarius and then its return to revisit some of the themes of Scorpio for 3 months, basically throughout the summer. We talked about the important Venus retrograde and how that's connected to the retrogrades of the summer of 2007 and 1999. We talked about that pile up in August of planets and stations and everything else in the first week or two of August. The final Uranus-Pluto square, which goes exact in March, although they'll still be sort of square by sign for the rest of the decade. So even though it's not going to be as intense as some of those exact points were, I think we'll still get some residual effects of that Uranus-Pluto square for the rest of the decade, probably.
Yeah, although I would like to say one thing about that, mm-hmm. and that's how people are going to experience that on a personal level. Instead of getting Uranus and Pluto at the same time, right? Because for the last several years, basically a person is having, you know, a Pluto transit and a Uranus transit to the same point in their chart simultaneously or nearly simultaneously.
Oh, right.
The rhythm is going to become Uranus next year Pluto.
Okay.
Right?
That's
which is different. Maybe not better, but different.
Sure. Yeah, that definitely was not pretty in many instances where people with stuff in early to mid cardinal signs were getting hit at the same time by both. So I can understand how that might be a little bit better, although then you still have sort of a sequence of a double punch that you're getting, but just spaced out a little bit, I guess.
It's going to be more this than that.
Okay.
But to be fair, you know, one of the things I see in a lot of my clients' lives and charts is that a lot of them are pretty good at handling life, and they can handle one thing at a time. But with the Uranus-Pluto, it's like, you know, there's a certain management threshold that I think everybody has, like how much they can kind of manage to deal with.
Sure.
And, you know, it's the simultaneous stuff that pushes a lot of people beyond that management threshold. And so even though, you know, it might be like, oh, no, I'm going to have this Uranus thing, I'm going to get all excited, and then Pluto's going to crush me, right? It's going to be one thing at a time. So at least you'll have the space to do one thing at a time rather than just, you know, all at once.
Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah, okay. So let's see. Uranus-Pluto square, the mutable mess that we're moving into in the second half of this year and the early part of next year. The Jupiter-Saturn square we talked about briefly in terms of the context of the greater 20-year cycle and how we're three-quarters of the way since the one in 2000. And then finally the eclipses in the spring and then the fall. Did you have any other points that you wanted to mention or touch upon about, I guess, just the general outlook for this year or general trends or themes or things that people should be aware of?
I guess I'd like to take just a second to kind of explain why I've subtitled my almanacs for the last several years. Mm-hmm. And I have like a penchant for kind of obscure things, sometimes in Latin.
Right.
And people always ask me, like, what does that mean? And why did you pick that?
Right.
And so last year I picked Casus Belli.
Oh yeah. That ended up being like really, appropriate. I think just a few months in, right?
Yeah. Well, you know, Casus Belli, for people who aren't familiar with it, it's a term, it's a Latin term, but it's been used for a long time to describe the case for war or the pretext for war.
Right.
Like the casus belli is the reason you give for going to war, right? And so, I don't know, it just kind of looked like people would be examining the case for war. Not necessarily going to war, but thinking of there'd be a lot of like almost war in 2014. And so, you know, with the whole Putin, Ukraine, U.S., you know, that whole mess. There was tons of looking at the case for war, right? Mm-hmm. So I felt pretty good about that one.
Yeah.
This year's title is actually more about the next couple years than it is about this year. But this theme is introduced this year. And so I picked interregnum. And an interregnum, so it's you've got reg and rex, you know, these Latin words that refer to kings. And inter is, you know, between. And so an interregnum is classically the period when the old king dies, but the new one hasn't taken office yet, right? And so they're interesting periods. And I guess metaphorically I'm seeing the last of the Uranus-Pluto squares is, you know, killing the last of the kings, right? Getting rid of some of these, you know, these structure, you know, these particular types of order and the people that represent them. You know, like Mubarak in Egypt or Gaddafi in Libya or whatever that asshole's name was in Ukraine. As I tried to make clear when we were talking about kind of bigger patterns, there's not necessarily going to be a new order that arrives, right, immediately. That's really the end of the decade and the beginning of the next. And so I think on a bigger level, we're kind of in it, we're entering this period of interregnum where there's no clear king. Right, it's not like, you know, in world affairs, for example, the United States is not the undisputed heavyweight of everything anymore. But it's not like some, it's not like another nation has become that, right? There are these kind of shifting alliances, and you know, it's unclear who's going to come out on top, and you know what things are going to look like, and that's really characteristic of an interregnum, of a time between, you know, stabilizing central forces, whether you like them or not, right? We didn't like them, so we rebelled for the first half of the decade against a lot of things. But like we said, that got rid of things, but it hasn't replaced them.
Right.
So yeah, that was my thinking on that.
Brilliant. I think that's a good descriptor, good sort of summary of where we're at right now. Okay, great. So. Yeah, so you just finished and published the Almanac for 2015, what, a few weeks ago, and people can get a hold of it on your website?
Absolutely. We've got paperback editions, and then there's also an ebook edition, a little nice bookmarked PDF that you can play on just about any device.
Perfect, yeah. I like the PDF edition particularly, although I love your print work in terms of the layout and design and everything else as well. Do you have any other major, I don't know, events or things you're doing this year that you wanted to promote?
Yeah, I probably should talk about that, eh? So I'm going to be giving a lecture for NCGR. I'm going to be part of, I think, a three-person big afternoon of workshops. And that's on, I think it's February 23rd. If it's not then, it's the day before. And I'm going to be talking about my recently published book on the Deccans, 36 Faces. So that'll be all the Deccans you can handle. The Deccans, of course, being the division of each sign into three. And so that should be fun. It's material I really like. And then in early April, I will be speaking at,
be speaking at the American Federation of Astrologers Conference.
Exactly.
In Phoenix, I think in late April.
And I'll also be doing some work on the Deccans there, although I'd like to, there'll be a little bit more general discussion of the use of images in astrology, and sort of looking at the way that we use words to delineate things, but we also use images. It's very hard to do astrology without a huge catalog of images. And so looking at sort of the way we do that and sort of the way that it's been done historically and using the Deccans, which are a particularly visually rich part of astrology, as a jumping off point. And then finally, the last thing that I'm certain that I'll be doing this year is I'll actually be speaking at a tarot conference in Denver June 26th through 28th. And there I'll be talking about the historical interrelationship between the Deccans and the tarot cards, especially the minor arcana and the way that the Deccans were used to actually build a lot of those meanings in the Rider-Waite deck and the Thoth decks, which are the most popular decks in the English-speaking world.
Okay, awesome. Excellent. Well, yeah, and then when you're in Denver, of course, I'll be hosting you for a workshop on hopefully something interesting that we'll figure out pretty soon as well. Great. All right. Well, thanks for coming on the show today to talk about upcoming trends and themes. And yeah, I would definitely recommend that people check out your website and order a copy of the Almanac, because it's really one of the only, it's like other people do almanacs kind of, but this is different. Like, you really put a lot into this, and it's very insightful in sometimes surprising and sort of interesting ways. So I really recommend that people check it out.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I also recommend people buy a copy. I recommend that they buy like 3 to 5 per person.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I analyze literally every aspect that occurs between every pair of planets the entire year. So.
Yeah, so this is no slouch almanac. And yeah, definitely multiple copies for just different parts of your house. I think I find are good, like the kitchen, one for the kitchen, one for the bedroom, of course, for, you know, reading it out loud to your romantic partner during intimate moments.
Yeah, yeah, or preceding them to, you know, really set the stage.
Right. All right. Well, on that note, I think that's a good note to wrap up on. So thanks, everyone, for listening to the Astrology Podcast. And I guess if you enjoyed this episode and you're listening to us through iTunes, then be sure to go on and give us a good rating. If you're not a subscriber already, then subscribe to the podcast through the sidebar so that you can get an email announcement when new episodes are posted. And yeah, I hope to be recording some more episodes soon after like a 3 or 4 month break because I got hit by my Saturn return and didn't feel like recording any episodes. So I'll be back shortly with some other episodes on various topics. So stay tuned and we'll see you next time.